Hi, I'm Nick Gillespie, and this is The Reason Podcast. Please subscribe to us at iTunes and rate and review us while you're there. Today, I'm joined by Reason Editor-in-Chief, Catherine Mangu Ward. Catherine, thanks for joining today.
Hi there, Nick.
And also by Matt Welch, Editor-at-Large of Reason. Matt, how you doing?
I'm doing great, Nick.
Great neck? I thought you were recording from Brooklyn.
That's this is going to get off to a really good start. If we go straight into the REM dreams, we'll save that for minute 75, I think.
Okay, so but you are in Brooklyn, right?
I am. Yes, I'm in Park Slope, beautiful Park Slope.
Park Slope, nightmare. Well, this is the Reason Podcast, where the three senior Reason people talk about the news of the week. And let's start off by talking about the phenomenal article about Steve Bannon and the interaction with him and Donald Trump and whatnot that was written, published in the New York Times Magazine by a person who has also written about Reason in the past, Robert Draper. Matt, do you want to summarize the story and what you took away as its key import?
Well, the what it shows, and it's interesting because a lot of the reporting was done before the implosion of RyanCare of last week, and you had a lot of quotes from Steve Bannon and President Trump himself already kind of tacking heavily away from, as if they were starting there from the beginning, but being very explicit in their sense of anti-libertarianism and occasionally pro-Keynesianism policies. In Trump's case, he talked about, he enthusiastically agreed with Draper's assessment that he's not interested and not planning on doing anything serious about entitlement reform. I think he always saw Obamacare as, you know, fixing the catastrophe. But then when you asked him throughout the campaign trail, his vision of what healthcare policy looks like is actually didn't have much in common with the people on Capitol Hill who've been wanting to reform or replace Obamacare for a long time. He's much more has a much more kind of government focused sense on extending coverage to people, having those insurance programs be tasked with covering a lot of different things. So in this article, he's like, oh yeah, for sure. And then he starts talking about what we really need to do is prime the pump. And he started using explicitly Paul Krugman-like concepts about stimulus spending, in effect. And he pointed specifically to his $1 trillion infrastructure proposal as a place that he's going to be focusing on, and we got to get that money out there in the economy. And we maybe talk a little bit later in the program about how that is going to be one of the next kind of coin tosses about the Trump presidency as a whole, because Democrats are lining up to the infrastructure thing saying, good, we get to spend $1 trillion, where there's a lot of free market people, including people who work for the Reason Foundation, who are hopeful, crossing their fingers, hopeful maybe, that this will be actually allowing private money to get off the sidelines and join in and build a bunch of toll roads and things like that. But the Steve Bannon quotes, he specifically name checks Cato, libertarian groups, Austrian economics, as they live in the fantasy land, and we need to go in the sort of this real direction of governance. I think it ratifies what we already kind of knew about Donald Trump, but it was interesting to be that explicit at this point in the presidency, particularly after the death of RyanCare on Friday, after which President Trump, Bannon, and other people made a lot of very explicit gestures towards criticizing the House Freedom Caucus in particular, who tend to be the most libertarian faction of the Republican Party, as being obstinate and unreasonable, and how now they're going to work with centrist Democrats. So I think as a whole, the Draper piece, which is fascinating reading, he's a very good reporter, paints us a picture of an attempt of an administration to already within 2 or 3 months of being alive, trying to ironically kind of bury the last remaining embers of the Tea Party movement, which in many ways they had taken over, at least out in the populist countryside. I think it's a very fascinating move on their part at a time when Democrats aren't very receptive to any a nod in their direction from the Trump presidency, because he's a deeply unpopular and polarizing figure.
Catherine, do you think that Austrian economics, given the xenophobia of this administration, do they have to start calling themselves like Alabama economics or something? Is it really just about the rebrand of,
I think,
of internationalism?
Austria is one of the foreign countries that's actually okay, I think, with this administration, and we will not Godwin our way into why that might be true. But
how about we call it Sound of Music, the Sound of Music School of Economics, or the Von Trapp family?
Von
singing.
Trapp.
Yeah.
Von Trapp sounds
theory
appropriately
of spontaneous order. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, now, I think this idea that, the quote from Bannon where he opens by trying to quote Tolstoy, but accidentally says it's Dostoevsky about unhappy families being unhappy in their own ways, then analogizes that to the two parties and then is like, and by the way, fuck libertarians. It's like a real masterpiece of Bannonian rhetoric.
It's this might be a place where we can say we add the Shaw gets turned into Shavian, maybe it's Bannovian, but and it's also I think his attributing everything to Dostoevsky is kind of like one more sign that he's the darkest human being on the planet. There's no sunshine, right?
Yeah, it's
Steve
just
Bannon's
all like,
world.
Why does God let babies die full time with that guy?
Here, two questions for you, Catherine, related to picking up on some of the things that Matt said. First is, what is the what do you think is the nut of the anti-libertarianism in a kind of Trumpian or and we're really talking about Bannon's ideas here, and we could, there's the further question of how much is he actually influencing or directing Trump, or whether Trump is using him and all of that kind of stuff. But what is the nut of the antagonism? And then the second one is, do they see somebody like Paul Ryan as libertarian? Because I get this a lot when I – well, let's answer the first question, and then maybe we can have a more general conversation about what is Paul Ryan's public – how does the public consume him? But what is it about libertarianism that these guys seem to hate?
So I think there's an answer that's flattering to libertarianism and one that isn't. The flattering answer is that libertarians, particularly the sort of Freedom Caucus variant of libertarians, are possibly the only people who have a principled line that they want to draw in opposition to Trump that he cares about at all. I mean, of course, he doesn't care if Bernie Sanders has a deeply principled and philosophically consistent line on why what Trump wants to do is bad. But these guys inside his own house who are not saying no because Trump annoys them, and they're not saying no because they're trying to get a better deal, but they are at least sometimes saying no because they think it is genuinely wrong to do what Trump wants to do. That's a real barrier in a way that the kind of wheeling and dealing of other Republicans seems less insurmountable. The less flattering version is that it's just, with Bannon in particular, like the daylight between Bannon and Ryan on any kind of, if we're going to reduce everything to high school, who sat at which lunch table, like it's just subtle shades of nerd hating on each other in a sort of small stakes one-upmanship, except for now it's large stakes.
Matt, what do you think?
I would add... So, I mean, the question of who is Paul Ryan kind of in that political psychographic measure is pretty interesting. I think he should be understood. There's been a lot of daft commentary since the Friday shenanigans. And sometimes you will see people say, Paul Ryan, he's just like an Ayn Rand bot and all of this. Paul Ryan was the vice presidential pick in 2012. He was the guy who, after they... Thomas Massie et al. Cashiered Boehner. He came in, and he actually, even before he became the Speaker of the House, he cobbled together the deal with Patty Murray after the Senate was retaken by Republicans to effectively get rid of the debt ceiling as a live political issue anymore, and to also get rid of the sequester cuts as a live political issue. So his job is to do establishment-y things, is to make deals, is to get stuff done. His job is no longer to sit up there and cook long-term, 50-year reforms of the budget process or Medicare or anything like that. That's not what he does anymore. And so what's fascinating is that Trump ran as the ultimate anti-establishment guy, right? And he comes into the Republican Party, comes into Capitol Hill, and a lot of, not all of, but a lot of the people who are now firmly inside the establishment. Reince Priebus is, Paul Ryan is, a whole lot, you know, Tom Cotton, even though he's a relatively newcomer, he is. These people, dutifully, and their media cohorts, Hugh Hewitt, for crying out loud, immediately flip and become Trumpian in very strong ways. It's almost as if he ran and he governed to prove that these people had no principles. But then what happens? He wants to get stuff done like anyone else who's ever in charge of anything. And he looks around and he sees what is the obstacle. And so he's going to have to grapple with this great cognitive dissonance, which is that he ran against gormlessness. And now he's attacking people who aren't getting gormless. And I don't even know what gormless means. So now I'm as confused as anybody else. But he ran against the sense of that people are unprincipled sellout who become part of the swamp and become part of the problem.
And then he's like, hurry up and become part of the swamp.
Hurry up and become part of the swamp. Let's ram together. And it's truly a ramming together, unlike Obamacare was done, which took a lot longer than RyanCare did. Let's ram together something that is almost historically unpopular, not just among the actual wonks, the people who were like Paul Ryan was 10 years ago. Every single free market healthcare analyst from Peter Suderman on down, because he exists at the top, as we all know, thought this thing was dreadful. But it was also something like 17% approval ratings out there for this plan. I mean, it was just awful. The CBO scores, Congressional Budget Office scores, all of it awful. And so to come out of this and your biggest lesson is, well, I know now who was disloyal to me, is remarkable. It's remarkable, and it's going to be this great piece of dissonance going forward. And it'll be interesting to see to what extent Trump's support base, to the extent that it still exists, recognizes any of this, as do anyone else. The problem with marginalizing the Freedom Caucus right now is that you do have to pass tax reform and other things, and you don't have the Democrats yet. So he's going to try to marginalize people who have, if anything, they have popularity more on their side or more trending on their side than Trump does. And I think it's just fascinating.
You mentioned the swamp, and I don't know about you guys, but when I think of swamps now, and I grew up in a part of the country where there were a lot of swamps in New Jersey. Many of them glowed beautifully even during the day and dark nights. But I always think of Cajun food. I always think of Louisiana bayous, and I'm not even sure. But now I'm hungry all of a sudden. And I realize I'm not going anywhere with this, so I'll flip it back to Catherine at this point, though. What is the – I want to get back to this question of, like, what is it that – I had a series of conversations last week with people, and one of the things I was saying, asking a bunch of media-type people – I was traveling in New York just – and kind of financial sector types – what do we need to do? What does reason need to do to kind of convince the Republican Party that, free minds and free markets, the idea of getting rid of, Trump's signature issues, and going back towards free trade, and towards, kind of tolerance and pluralism, these great classical liberal ideas. What do we need to do to make the Republicans understand that's the party of the future? And half of them were like, those are terrible ideas. I mean, is this the world is the world turning against what reason has stood for and actually, seen huge advances in things like the end of tariffs, essentially, or the major reduction of worldwide global tariffs, a understanding that there is a international community that is important. It doesn't necessarily supplant national community or local community. I mean, is it that people like Bannon see libertarians as kind of, are we the effete latte sippers that the Club for Growth under Steve Moore, who is now, an advisor at distance to the Trump candidacy, is that who we are to people like that? And if so, how do we address that?
One of the weird throw-offs from this disaster around RyanCare or whatever it is that we're calling it, is I've seen in many different places people saying, like, I hope that this finally puts paid to the myth of Paul Ryan as the wonk king or as the virtuous wonk, right? And I think that that's a thing, that's a function that libertarians have always served for Republicans, is to say, you know, while you guys are out there glad-handing in your Navy blazers, we're going to be over here in the corner with the spreadsheets in case anyone's ever interested in doing actual policy reform. Because, you know, someone's got to do that. It might as well be us. And, you know, I think one thing that this has shown is that the existence of that spreadsheet somewhere in the world does not necessarily translate into policy, even when the guy who maybe was the maker of that spreadsheet is in charge of writing the legislation. And that, you know, I don't actually think that Paul Ryan as Wonk King was a lie. I just think he's doing something else now. And I think that's what Matt was saying about, you know, people being kind of absorbed into the mainstream of this administration versus sniping from the outside.
But maybe it's also true, and I realize we've both, you know, we've interviewed Paul Ryan at various points, and he's been friendly in certain ways. But one of the main arguments, or one of the main problems I always had with him, is that for all of his wonkiness, he's like playing a game of Tetris or something, or he wants to pack the perfect grocery bag at the, you know, in the checkout aisle. He was never interested in fundamentally libertarian reform in terms of reducing the size, scope, and spending of government. And I think that, you know, and that's before he was Speaker of the House. That's when he was, you know, still like the Jack Kemp protege in the early 2000s. And it seems to me like we should be holding him accountable and the Republican Party. I mean, forget Trump for a second, who's, you know, one thing. The Republicans had, 7 years or more to come up with a goddamn free market alternative to Obamacare, or to have implemented one under George Bush. And they didn't do dick about that. I mean, and then they come up with a program that sucks from everybody's perspective. It's so bad they can't even get all the Republican votes, much less a single Democratic vote. And it fails. And that's a big Luger hanging off of Paul Ryan's face and the Republican leadership and you know, clearly Donald Trump as well. But I mean, they're not serious. And, you know, Paul Ryan was always being pilloried for he was going to destroy Medicare by constantly in his budget blueprints talking about voucherizing or giving premium support to Medicare after the budget window that was being talked about in whatever document he was publishing was actually going to start. He's the cabin boy rearranging deck chairs on the Titanic. He's never been a bold visionary, and I think that comes through here. And
But bold visionaries aren't even part of the conversation. I mean, I guess I actually think that Paul Ryan of, you know, 10 years ago was doing a pretty great job of walking the line between trying to, you know, repack the grocery bag or whatever, but also keeping the end goal in mind of we at least need to constrain these programs. We at least need to stop the rate of growth. We at least need to do it that in a way that will be long-term enough, that it will be palatable. I mean, I actually think that project is a noble one and one that we should be engaged in. But when we are looking at a landscape where we have Donald Trump saying, let's prime the pump, and when asked about the border adjustment tax, he replies, I am the king of that. This is no longer an environment where anyone can even hear anything like even the most moderate of reform plans, I don't think, and the total failure of Ryan Care demonstrates
that. Just to harp on this, and Matt, get your opinion in hopes of finding somebody who agrees with me more than Catherine does. In the Draper story, the Robert Draper story in the New York Times Magazine, which is just really great. I mean, it's a masterclass, as always, in reporting and writing, but it has a ton of fascinating content in it. The one thing that Trump and Bannon and Paul Ryan could get around was the border adjustment tax, which is essentially a tax on imports that works through the corporate system. Rather than the personal tax, personal income tax. But, you know, that's something Ryan has been into for years. And it's just such a dumb and complicated idea. you know, is there, you know, what, where do we go from here? Where do libertarians go in the wake of this failure, which is pretty gigantic on the part of Republicans? And I would argue it shows them as fundamentally unserious in governing because they didn't actually come up with and sell a plan. And there was stuff out there like Rand Paul's plan was a better alternative than this for sure. You know, there have been 1,000 different alternative proposals for a free market system in healthcare. You know, what do we do to point this out to people and say, like, look, Obamacare is a disaster. It's built upon, you know, it's built upon the lie that you could keep your doctor. It is, you know, it forces people to engage in economic activity that they don't want to, which is morally and ethically repugnant, and it's not working. You know, now it's time for, you know, look at the sleek new libertarian models of 2017. They're coming to showrooms all around you.
You were cutting in somewhat there on the question. However, I will do as I usually do, which is not really pay attention to it and just start talking. But no, the border adjustment tax, this was always going to be the big heave number two. Obamacare reboot was number one, and that totally crashed and burned. And tax reform slash border adjustment tax was always going to be the second big, awful, complicated thing that's going to happen. And what the Draper article underlines and what we've seen quotes over the weekend and even today, including from Chuck Schumer, interestingly enough, who said that he is going to be open to doing business with Trump on a border adjustment tax because goodness knows Democrats, the beating heart of Democratic economic philosophy right now has gone just running, screaming from the Bill Clinton, Al Gore era of approach towards trade and now is resting in the bosom of Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren. And I'm sorry for that image.
Jesus Christ.
So
this is family friendly.
That's true.
It's really not.
So the question as to what libertarians could do is pretty similar to the question of what we could have done and what role we served after the, as in the words of a great philosopher, Nick Gillespie, our national pants shitting moments of the fall of 2008, when you had people like the Wall Street Journal editorial page and David Brooks, and I think even The Economist magazine and everybody else saying, you know, enough with you nihilists out there. We need to do something in order to fix the financial crisis. And it kind of doesn't matter what that thing is. Let's just do it. And we were pretty lonely in the wilderness there saying, you know, when you're in that position, you're about to do something bad. And here's how it can go bad. And almost everything that we described in terms of what could go wrong then promptly did go wrong. And it's still wrong with us today in terms of a sluggishly growing recovery and this huge debt overhang that that is haunting us. So what we do is remind people, hey, look, there's a reason why you are greeting these ideas with record disapproval ratings of the president and his plans. There is muscle memory in the United States of America among its citizens that at some point you can't keep just doing this. There are, for instance, there's the debt ceiling is about to expire again, like this week or next week. It won't. No one's going to. It's if it gets anywhere close, Republicans led by Paul Ryan and everybody else will wave the magic wand and it'll once again disappear because now that they control things, they don't want impediments to their governance. But that was, as I've mentioned before, one of the only things about Republican brinksmanship back in the day that was genuinely popular. Americans don't like the fact that we're running such a huge high debt. They disagree strenuously about what to do after that. So our job is to remind people of the reality of how arithmetic works and hope and have some kind of sense of optimism that there will be receptive audiences out there. There's going to be a post-Trumponomics. And the question is, what does that look like on the Democratic side? Right now, I don't have very much in the way of a good feeling about that. There's been a long trend more towards Bernie-nomics and away from the kind of 1990s sense of things. And then what's it going to look like on the Republican side? And the one good thing about the way this all went down is that I believe in that the House Freedom Caucus allowed the country and also the Republican Party to dodge a bullet. I think that even though Ted Poe, who is a member of the Freedom Caucus, has showily resigned, even though the Wall Street Journal editorial page blames the House Freedom Caucus solely for this terrible result and all these kind of things, I still think that ultimately they will gain more power in the court of popular opinion, including among the Republican Party. And when we get to sort of thinking about post-Trumpism, we're going to want there to be a place that is receptive to our ideas. So we just keep pushing the rock uphill, Nick.
All right. And Catherine, I want to make sure in case any of our staff is listening, or any of our staff, and we'll get to the difficulty with possibly plural, possibly singular pronouns in a little bit. But, you know, that at Reason, we also believe that safety is job number one. How many days has it been without a life-threatening injury at a Reason facility? Do we have a count on that?
One.
Okay. Well, it's good. It's Monday, so we're on a hot streak so far. What are you looking forward to the discussion about tax reform? Do you think it will go any better than you know, than what we've seen with healthcare reform, or is it going to be? I mean, because the Freedom, I guess this, Matt, to your point, the Freedom Caucus and kind of the modal Republican mindset of just let's cut all taxes all the time. There's more consonance there, but do you have any reason to believe, Catherine, that tax reform will be a more will be a smoother process than healthcare reform for the Republican Party?
You know, I actually think the phrase tax reform contains a lot more possibilities than healthcare reform does, which is going to be problematic. When people hear tax reform, they can hear anything from let's close some loopholes and simplify the tax code slightly, all the way to, you know, let's institute a fair tax, or let's institute a flat tax, or let's, you know, change so that our budget is funded entirely by tariffs. Or, I mean, you know, you can hear almost anything in there. And I suspect that people are right now bridging that gap by hand-waving those differences away, and we are about to stop being able to do that. I think decreasing the corporate tax is the strongest point of commonality, and I think it's a good idea. But I also think that, at least what I'm hearing among libertarian wonky types, is that you know, Republicans are for cutting taxes, libertarians are for cutting taxes and correspondingly cutting spending. And that's an oversimplification, but it seems to be an increasingly important point to make. And of course, we did a cover story before the election about what the fiscal record was of the various candidates, not in terms of cutting taxes, but in terms of actually cutting government or setting up the conditions to cut government. In one of our prouder moments as a magazine, we didn't even include Donald Trump in that feature because at the time it seemed wildly unlikely that he would be president. So we failed to consider the outside possibility that we will get a president who, as far as I can see, has no interest in cutting the spending of government, though he has expressed interest in cutting the regulatory scope, and instead is just going to cut taxes. And that, I think, is in some ways, it's not a worst case scenario, but it's not a good scenario because it gives tax cutting a bad name.
Yeah, and also, I mean, you know, part of our problem, I think, as a country, is that we've been working with what I once called Groupon, government by Groupon, by a coupon, where we're spending, you know, under a large chunk of Obama's administration, for instance, we were borrowing about 33 cents on every dollar of spending. And, you know, it's like a discount. Like, why wouldn't you buy, even if you don't want the government services, why wouldn't you buy a dollar worth of shit if it only costs you 66 cents out of pocket? And that goes back to Reagan. In a lot of ways, Reagan's great innovation was to, you know, get rid of any concerns about just kind of peacetime debt in order to get whatever you wanted done. And we've, you know, the budget has never really recovered. We've had mounting deficits and hence debt since then. Matt, do you think one of the things, and you're a New York resident, Chuck Schumer, oddly, is, and Catherine was pointing out, that there is overlap between Democrats and Republicans on the idea of cutting the corporate business tax because it's screwy and things like that. Schumer along with Senator Hillary Clinton, who, you know, whatever she's up to. But they would always vote in favor of patching the alternative minimum tax because it hit a lot of their constituents who tend to be wealthier and hence subject to that, as well as corporate taxes, because, you know, New York City is a town of corporations. Do you think that the tax discussion about tax reform outside of the, you know, there's the within the Republican Party aspect of things, but then across the parties will go more smoothly than, you know, what we saw with the healthcare debacle?
No. And the reason is, for me, that it actually hasn't been worked on. I mean, you referenced before, and rightly so, Nick, that Republicans had 6-7 years to come up with a repeal replacement plans for Obamacare. They actually passed a lot of bills in that process. Some of them were even seen as not terrible. You know, Tom Price, who's now the Secretary of Health and Human Services, he'd worked in a serious way on these things. They had done some spade work, obviously terribly inadequate, and equally as obvious, they were much more interested in demagoguing and doing things like Ted Cruz shutting down the government and these kind of ridiculous politics of it. But still, they did at least some work. They haven't been doing the work on tax reform. Every single thing that has taken a long time that people talk about, comprehensive immigration reform, tax reform, you know, cutting wasteful military projects, things that you can't, that somehow have not been able to be done in Washington for a long time. I think there's a good rule of thumb. There's a reason why they're not done. There are even two reasons. One, it's really complicated, and two, very tied up within that. There are incentives for not getting it done. Having a complicated tax code with high taxes that allows Congress to come in and carve out for their own constituents little workarounds from those taxes allows senators and congresspeople to go and say, hey, look, I saved you from this. Aren't you happy? Why don't you give me some campaign contributions here? It is in everyone's best interest. In order to do real tax reform, I believe you would have to go after the mortgage interest deduction, which is ultimately using the tax code to benefit people who are richer than me. And so I resent that very strongly. But that you're never going to get rid of that thing. Who has been doing the hard work on laying the groundwork for the kind of trade-offs that a real tax reform would get? So, yeah, people will talk about it. We got this 35% corporate tax. It's obviously one of the highest in the world. We also
And nobody pays it.
And nobody pays it.
Because it's the highest tax rate in the world.
Yeah. And, you know, let's repatriate all this capital from Apple and other people by having some kind of tax holiday. We know what the ideas are out there. Or, you know, I would like to hear something about, let's end the IRS's worldwide taxation on American humans and corporations, which is pretty unique in the world. But there's a reason why all of these things exist. So no, they haven't been doing the hard work on this. And because of that, and also because of, I think that Trump will insist on a border adjustment tax, and there will be a hardcore group probably centered around the House Freedom Caucus that will say, hey, I don't like tariffs. I think I'm pessimistic from their point of view that anything will happen, but I'm optimistic somehow that things that might be terrible will be avoided.
You're living in a dream world, Matt Welch. You probably think the California Angels of Los Angeles and Anaheim and now Riverside are going to do well in the upcoming baseball season as well.
I may be optimistic, but I'm not delusional.
Catherine, why don't we talk about the kind of world-shattering AP-style guide change that just happened? And for those of you who are thankfully not in professional journalism, AP style is a thing. The Associated Press, because of its impact and reach, they have a style guide where they say, use this kind of locution to describe this, put proper names, identify people in this format, et cetera. They just made a pretty and most newspapers, most organizations, including Reason, follow at least a modified version of the AP style handbook. What did the AP do recently, and why is it kind of fascinating, really?
I feel like maybe the AP got tired of no one paying attention to them, so they did a bunch of controversial things in this update, the most controversial of which is probably that they are allowing for the first time the use of the word they as a singular pronoun. And it's a limited change. They say essentially that
they say
they. Well, this is a collective they in yeah. that case. But the allowance of the use of they as a singular or gender neutral pronoun when an alternate wording is overly awkward or clumsy. So their guidance is still to write around it if you can, because, of course, it's confusing. Is there more than one person there or just a person who prefers that pronoun? But people are taking this as kind of a sign of the times changing. They also added Q to LGBTQ. And Reason's own Scott Shackford is over at Twitter right now losing his mind about that in a way that's very interesting and instructive. So I urge people follow.
They is losing his mind over this?
That was definitely wrong in all the ways. And they also changed the spelling of kimchi. So there you go, ladies and gentlemen. Your update from the front of grammar.
Yeah, I'm a fan of DJ Khaled, the super producer and rap performer who he doesn't do this as much now that he's got more famous, but he used to get on to he would do elliptical training. He's a large gentleman, to put it diplomatically. But he would do live streams while doing elliptical and aerobic training, and he would start to get out of breath. It was really pretty mesmerizing. But one of his he did a lot of kind of self-help, Tony Robbins style talking, and his refrain was always, they don't want you to succeed. They don't want you to be better than you are. They don't want you. And now I have to go back and relook at all of those things, because was he talking about a singular person, or was he talking about a large group of shadowy internationalists or something like that?
Like, you think there was one person sitting across from him holding the camera who preferred a gender-neutral pronoun and he just hated that person?
I think it might be that, yeah. And DJ Khaled is nothing if not a master. I mean, he's a master of beats, of course, but also of linguistics. And so this I'm happy to see this kind of stuff. I have no problem. I guess, as like the world's worst self-proofreader, I should, judiciously step out of this conversation. But this is language evolution, isn't it? I mean, and even if because the AP is not creating this change, they're certifying a change in the way that we write and we talk. And is this something from a kind of Hayekian common law, multiple sites of evolution, of social evolution and human evolution? Shouldn't we be celebrating this Catherine Mangue Award?
I actually think we should. I am in favor of this change. And I think it's interesting that a significant number of the changes in this style book have to do with sex and sexual identity. I think that's the thing we're trying to figure out how to talk about right now. And the fact that AP is evolving to reflect that, but not jumping all over the most radical variant just to please activists, is the right approach. They also admit the use of the word homophobia, which they had previously said, no, phobias are mental illness. We don't conflate those with, disdain or dislike or whatever. So there's a bunch of places where they're reflecting is we're having a national conversation about how to use words to talk about people's gender identity, and that's appropriate. I also like not to go all Nicolesby Pop-Tarts on people, but I like the idea of people being able to make up their own or label their own identities however they like and to sort of customize it to the point that they're satisfied. I do think when we get to a place where it becomes subject of legal sanctioned when you use the wrong pronoun, we have gone too far, and we are marching boldly up to that place. So I am on alert for that. But anything short of that just strikes me as delightful self-expression.
Matt, during the great, I think one of the great definitional, literally and figuratively definitional debates of the 1990s, where were you on the great issue of whether or not Alanis Morissette understood what irony meant?
Because
It's related, though, of like the stuffed shirts being like, oh, she doesn't even know what irony is. How could you, why is she selling millions of records? And why, that's why Dave Coulier broke up with her.
I think it's important to not impose AP style, maybe Chicago style, but not AP style on 90s pop songs. I think there lies madness. In general, I'm totally with a Hayekian view of language. There's a reason why American English is the best language on the planet, because we don't get too uptight about usage. We welcome foreigner talk. We welcome new ways of inverting phrases and all of that kind of stuff. And you can feel the butt coming in here. And here's my butt.
I'm already dialing 911 in anticipation, but please continue.
It's wrong. They is plural. Right?
We don't have a gender-neutral singular. Thing. We have to borrow it from somewhere.
His or her.
They is better than the one of the made-up, you know. Like,
no. If something is plural, it's plural. If something is singular, it's singular. And you
what
just...
is... Come on, Matt.
I recall...
What are you, do you work for Dean Wormer at Faber College or something?
I also...
Here? Like, you know, loosen up, man.
I also appreciate...
Come on, Daddy-O.
In the same way that, like... sometimes recording artists talk about how it's much better to work on, you know, an 8-track recording device than use all the Pro Tools and stuff. I like that this awkwardness imposed by both the English language and the AP style book requires you to do gymnastics to write it better. I like the exercise of attempting to do that, although I don't necessarily like that as much when I'm on deadline. Than otherwise. So it's simply inaccurate. So if you're going to have professional writing, I think you got a problem.
Man.
However,
the thing though
I can
is that
back
you,
to the
Matt, you have
century.
A total jihad on word repetition, and the result when you try to write around pronouns is that you wind up overusing a person's name in a way that sounds bizarre and condescending. I actually think writing around it doesn't produce better writing.
Yeah, it usually doesn't. You're not wrong about that. I will
recall writing. Good writing comes from good thinking. You can't have good writing without good thinking. So it's really what we need to be talking
that's
about.
Absolutely
is
not true.
Here.
Thanks a lot, Strunk.
It is true.
Absolutely not
now,
true.
Now, Strunk is the opposite. Strunk is all about style, isn't it? It's I'm talking about there were a bunch of progressive educators in the composition space in the 70s and 80s who were like. You know, when you get shitty freshman college essays or high school, you know, whatever, most of the time people actually speak fairly, possessed and communicative language, but they choke up when they're writing because a lot of the times we're asking them to write about stuff that they haven't thought about. And, muddy thinking leads to muddy writing. That's my point. And it's not fixed simply by outlining your points.
Yeah, I think Ernest Hemingway was a pretty crappy thinker about a lot of stuff. But
his stories you can never follow the plot. You get lost in the words.
Do we have to talk about the
joke.
Opening?
Yeah, all right, that was a real, real, kind of neutron bomb of a Hemingway joke. I just hope the microphones are still working wherever Matt and Catherine are recording from.
We both hung up. We're out.
Yeah. Catherine, as a closing point and on an up note, the latest issue of Reason, which is just a fucking cavalcade and of interesting material, and the cover story or the cover package really is about why border walls don't work. And in fact, there's a great piece about how the border wall we have, the border walls are only going to be a boon to drug and human smugglers. But I wanted to talk specifically about the cover, which is the result of a particular printing process that you took advantage of with Joanna Andresen, our art designer. It is absolutely a staggering experience to pick up the latest print issue of Reason and open that cover. Can you talk a little bit about what it is and what went into that process? Because it really, this is one of those cases where, get the print copy of the latest issue of Reason, because just opening the cover, I found it genuinely moving and it's impactful, which I realize is one of those words people either like or dislike. But what's going on in the cover?
So the cover package is Why the Wall Won't Work. And we took advantage of Joanna and I went down to visit our printer in Little Rock. It was a really cool experience just to see how the magazine is physically produced. And while we were down there, we saw some examples of other work that they can do, including laser cutting covers. So our cover has a big hole in it, just like Trump's wall almost certainly will. And it's when you open it up, you see right through to Mexico. So that is the general gist of the thing. I actually loved, I thought there was a bunch of good stuff in this issue about the wall, but the tidbit that I liked the most was a sidebar to the cover package called Drug Smugglers Have Already Beaten Trump's Wall. It's by Teresa Cardinal Brown, who's a former DHS staffer, and she just describes all the ways that people are already thwarting walls just like the ones that Trump wants to build more and more of. So if you need more information about how to smuggle your marijuana via catapult, Reason Magazine this month.
Well, and that has that's the story that has the it's like a SUV or something that's already like backed up on ramps over an existing part of the wall.
Right. And to be fair to Donald Trump, which I do try to do, this particular wall that has the SUV straddling on top of it, jammed up there, it's not the type of wall that Trump favors. It's vertical bollards that people can pass things through. It is not as tall as the wall that Trump would build. It is not as beautiful as the wall that Trump would build, I think he would want me to say. But still, it's a great example of how this like incredible, you know, spiked pikes kind of fortress looking thing, people literally just put a ramp and drove their car up over it. And this particular car got stuck. But the reason that they were doing it is because most of them don't. So,
well, the I mean, if Matt, this is an old libertarian sub, but like if we can't keep drugs, you know, out of prisons, how are we going to keep them across a border that is even more difficult to police? Do you see any shift? Well, I guess, Matt, for you, two questions. One is, do you see any shift in public opinion away from kind of Mexophobia? As opposed to, you know, people are worried, and I think it's legitimate for them to, you know, be worried about terrorists and bad people coming into the country and doing bad things. But has the focus of ire shifted away from Mexico and Mexicans? Because that was what Trump and Catherine, in your excellent note where you opening essay in the issue, where among other things you set people right on what Robert Frost was talking about in Mending Wall, his famous poem. But Matt, are we less worried about Mexicans now or not? And also, how important to the people that you hang out with, like your neighbors and whatnot in Brooklyn, a very liberal enclave, a super liberal enclave, how important is it to be right with them on immigration, by which I simply mean that you're not seen as xenophobic? Is that, if you don't have that, the conversation is over?
I think it's always important in American politics to be aware of the pendulum effect. So at any given time, when it really looks like we are forever going to be in X, that's a pretty good sign to start betting long on Y. And you and I talk about this at great length in a Declaration of Independence, Nick. And I think that's right. The go-to possible historical analogy for our current expression and kind of ratification of what has been a minority strain in mostly Republican politics of simple-minded kind of either Mexophobia or simple-minded, we have an easy solution to a complicated immigration problem, is what happened with Pete Wilson in California in 1993, 1994. When a guy who was already governor of California, a Republican, a moderate from San Diego, was 20 points underwater, and he was looking around and noticing that in the post-Cold War kind of recession-ravaged early 90s California, that there was a rise in kind of blaming the Mexicans on stuff. So he went all in on that and was successful, as was Proposition 187 in 1994. And so a lot of people go back and read the coverage of, you know, the LA Times and New York Times elsewhere. It's like, wow, that's, you know, it's going to be all anti-immigration from here on out. Well, actually, it's going to be, that's the last we'll ever see of Republicans not named Arnold Schwarzenegger, Republicans who have themselves been possibly illegal immigrants from here on out in California. That effectively croaked the Republican Party. There's people who dispute that, but I think that's that is broadly more true than not true. And I think, you know, Donald Trump's sense solutions for immigration have never really been a majoritarian among the American population. And it's something that you've written about a lot, Nick. Most Americans kind of favor the direction of where comprehensive immigration reform was going, as flawed as that set of packages definitely has been over the years. People want a path towards some kind of legal normalization, whether that looks like citizenship or something else. And so after this expression, when we're going to go through at least some of this wall building, which we have been doing for the last 20 years, as this great package does point out. But after we go through the eminent domain fights, after we see the end result of all of this, which is going to be more people dying in the desert, people realizing that the largest majority, the greatest number of people who become illegal in this country, and this is huge numbers already, are people who came here legally, not because they swam across the border. It's because they came here on a student visa or some other type of visa and just overstayed. So after all of this,
and are increasingly from the two biggest groups now are Chinese and Indians, both for legal and unauthorized immigration. So Mexicans are third.
Who don't come over the southern border. After all of this, plus the unpopularity of Donald Trump, unless something strange happens, and things do happen strangely in American politics. Let's be clear about that. You know, if the economy suddenly goes great for the next 5 years, these predictions might be wrong. I'm doubtful about all of that. So the pendulum will swing backwards. And I think we might see, particularly given that millennials hold up as their primary political virtue being opposed to bigotry, I think we might see will be the beginning of the end. But we don't know where that pendulum is. It's still maybe doing a backswing. We still maybe have a ways to go on this. And we certainly have a lot of individual lives that will be swept up into whatever is going to happen next. So eventually it'll go back and swing in the other direction. But I don't know where we are right there.
I run into this argument a lot. Like, you know, show me one place where Donald Trump has said he's against immigration. He's only against illegal immigration. Or I'm not against immigration, I'm just against illegal immigration. I'm looking forward to the moment where that becomes, I'm not against all illegal immigration, I'm just against Mexican illegal immigration. And
a point about that that we always stress, but it's worth stressing every time we talk about it, is that he wants to cut down, and his closest advisors, led by Steve Bannon, wants to cut down pretty drastically the amount of legal
50% from governors Cotton and Perdue. Republican senators introduced legislation almost a month ago now to say legal immigration, which has been around a million people a year. They hate H-1B visas, which is a program for workers in short supply, et cetera. But yeah, so I mean, like, I don't know anybody who is actually in favor of immigration who is also against illegal immigration. The two are intertwined because, Matt, as you were saying, a lot of illegal immigrants, certainly they come to the country, and it's something like two-thirds now. It used to be 40%. Came in legally on a travel visa, a student visa, whatever, and then overstay. Now it's up to two-thirds, so rendering the whole wall idea kind of ridiculous. But it did give rise absolutely, Catherine, just one of the greatest fucking covers in recent history. So the untold suffering and misery of millions of people, and I'm making a joke here, you know, at least it gave rise to a really great cover. But I think, Matt, one of the things that is really always worth talking about and pointing out is the misery that gets inflicted by these dumb, stupid rules. You know, because I like you, am generally optimistic about things. And, you know, we are witnessing in a way that I never thought we would, you know, the end of the war on drugs. We're taking baby steps towards that and whatnot. But between now and the end of pot legalization, there will literally be millions of people whose lives are absolutely ruined waiting for the obvious to happen. And you know, when we should never lose sight of, you know, the human toll of all of this kind of stuff.
I mean, to shout out one of your greater headlines is, you know, who will be the last one to die for the drug war, daddy, is something we should never lose sight of.
Actually, it was, what did you do during the drug war, daddy?
Whatever. Don't correct me.
Yeah. But Catherine, where can people subscribe to and buy Reason magazine? Because again, and the reason I'm harping on the cover is we've got three editors of the magazine here. We've each had like kind of spectacular covers. This is just such a masterpiece. And I think I mentioned to you in a previous conversation, I'm, you know, and it's partly because obviously I have, you know, all sorts of medical problems. But when I opened that cover up, I was staggered by it. I actually literally sat down because I was like, it took my breath away. It is so powerful. I showed it to my sons and they were knocked out by it and kind of almost laughing because it's just so great. I really hope that people seek out the physical object on this. And what's the best way for them to do that?
They can subscribe at Reason.com. They can go to their friendly neighborhood newsstand, if such a thing still exists anywhere near them, and pick up a copy. Of course, I will say, Nick, that on my Twitter feed, as people were getting their issues in the mail, lots of people saying, this cover is awesome. I love it. Not quite as good. Not quite as good as the one with the picture of my house on it. That was the best cover ever. So damn you, Gillespie, for your gold standard.
Why couldn't it be about something other than illegal immigration, which I'm against? And I will end this Reason talk show podcast with a true story from Queens, New York, where a couple of Reason TV guys and myself, we had taped a couple of things and we were getting into an Uber and a guy drove by and he was like, hey, Reason, right? Reason. And he literally held up the issue. I put it in both the Reason Twitter feed as well as my own, but a guy named Tanver Troy, who grew up in Queens, and he was showing the issue and like opening the cover, and it was, you know, it's those kinds of moments that are really it's special to be working with you guys and to be part of an organization like Reason, where you know that people are, you know, we're channeling a lot of energy and a lot of ideas and pushing it back to people in ways that has an influence on them. So thank you for all that. We'll end it here. This is the Reason Podcast. We've been talking with Matt Welch, editor-at-large of Reason. Matt, thanks for participating.
Good times.
And we've been talking with Reason editor-in-chief, Reason Magazine editor-in-chief, Catherine Mangu Ward. Thank you, Catherine.
Thank you, Nick.
And I am Nick Gillespie. This has been the Reason Podcast. Please subscribe to us at iTunes and rate and review us while you're there. Thanks for listening.